the week of January 8th, 2017. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 350, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Gills. 350, what a nice round number.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what it means. But
it means almost 6 years.
Well, okay.
Almost seven years.
That's right, yes.
Dear God.
Yes, we can do math here.
To have a 10th year anniversary before you know it.
Oh, my goodness. Time flies. Let's hope the next 4 years does as well.
That's right. Let's hope this episode flies. What will we be talking about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll hope that you, Michael, can dig yourself out of the snow long enough to discuss the box office, which this week is one of the closest races for number one we've seen in ages. And the winner is, well, we're not sure because the math is a little tricky and we just kind of proved that we don't know how to do it. Now, where can we find some bright and talented people to do that math for us without letting anyone know they helped? Anyway, we are sure that the Writers Guild and the National Society of Film Critics have both weighed in with end-of-the-year honors. Do they matter come Oscar time? Well, the writer's pen is mightier than the critical sword. And then there's the Golden Globes. Yes, we will be discussing them. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to tout a debut fantasy novel and a memoir about microdosing on LSD as properties that studios will want to snap up. On Inside Baseball, we'll talk with Brooks Barnes of the New York Times about Hollywood.
Hallelujah.
Yes. There's a reason you're saying that, because we're talking about Hollywood's ever more sophisticated outreach to the faith community, and not just for Ben-Hur, but on mainstream movies like Hidden Figures and Sully. Why are they doing this? We'll ask him that very question. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Now, when we talked about that horse race to the finale of the box office, that was about North American numbers. Worldwide, the winner is clear. The number one movie around the world. We get our information from Comscore and a bunch of other people. You've heard about them before. It's Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. $78 million over the weekend, $914 million worldwide. In 2 weeks, it will have passed the $1 billion mark, which is half the amount of the last Star Wars movie. But if you think that's a bad result, you're crazy.
Yeah, no. I mean, the last Star Wars movie was the first Star Wars movie in over 20 years. So, yeah, I think there was some
It was part of the classic narrative, and this is somewhat off to the side. You know, it's very much part of the same story, frankly, but it's different actors. It's mostly not the same characters. It's, it's a one-off.
Did you see the film?
I did.
And what did you think of it?
I didn't think it was good, but I liked it better than A Force Awakens.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, I thought that one was such an awful reboot of the original Star Wars. It was just literally the same story. This at least was a little different. They were trying for something different. I don't think it will wear well on a second viewing, but when I saw it, I was like, well, that didn't suck.
You know, when I saw it, there was a person next to me who started answering texts halfway through,
emails.
And I thought to myself, well, that I guess kind of, that kind of tells you whether this movie is keeping people's attention.
Well, they might have done that in any movie, right?
Well, don't get me started. Yes.
Yeah. Well, number two around the world is a movie that is not getting a lot of good attention. It's Assassin's Creed, based on the video game. $48 million over the weekend, $150 million worldwide. We'll have to see if the big names in that movie can help it around the world, because it's certainly falling fast in North America. And number three is Sing, the animated movie about animals taking part in an American Idol-type competition. $45 million over the weekend, $350 million worldwide. This sucker is zeroing in on Moana numbers. I think Moana will ultimately beat it, but boy, Sing is doing very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, I know I hear kids saying they want to go back and see it again.
Well, there you go. And number four is Passengers, the Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence film, $41 million over the weekend, $185 million worldwide. And number five is Moana, the movie we just spoke about, the Disney film, another $26 million over the weekend. It's hit $450 million worldwide. It's in fewer territories, though, than Sing, which is now in 62 different countries and territories, whereas Moana has a longer, slower campaign to go. So that'll be the tortoise that beats the hare. And number six is the movie that did beat Rogue One at the box office here in North America. It's Hidden Figures. $22.8 million is the numbers we're looking at come Monday. The Monday actuals is what that's known as. It's now at just about $25 million and counting in total from that one territory. It really edged out Rogue One by a couple $100,000. A very, very tight race for the box office claim here in the U.S. Does that still matter?
Well, yes, it does. In North America, absolutely. Yeah, it does, because, you know, that's, you know, when
it matters in every country.
Yeah,
right?
well, and you'll hear and see on television commercials, you know, go see this weekend, go see the number one movie of the nation.
Right. And this is a terrific success, because this is not a slam dunk necessarily at the box office, but you've got very strong critical acclaim. You've got audience scores. They're loving the movie, and they've launched it successfully after a platform release. So this is really positioned well to be a big commercial hit. Not a given for a movie about three black women, unfortunately. Will it cross over overseas? Will they release this movie? Fences isn't really planned to be released in other territories. They're leaving money on the table, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, having been to the theater this weekend, I actually watched, whole families go to see Hidden Figures. They were, you know, mothers taking their daughters to see Hidden Figures. So It's a
family-friendly movie, a positive message about self-empowerment and speaking up for yourself and the talents of people. And that's one reason why this is one of the movies that used a outside firm to pitch it to faith-based mega churches and pastors and other people around the country, which is the thing we'll talk about with Brooks Barnes later in the show.
That's right. And now you mentioned the actuals, right? So, the estimateds, it looked like Rogue One had beaten Hidden Figures here in North America. It was like 21.9 million versus 21.8 million. You could just see that the distribution executives at Disney kind of trying to figure out what the distribution executives at Fox were going to tell the press. And they say, well, let's go 21.972 and hope that Fox says something less. And they did, but barely. But then when the actuals came in, it didn't matter.
Well, it looked like Fox was being conservative all weekend in their estimates, whereas Disney was being on target or just slightly optimistic.
Well, and Disney kind of was on edge, supposedly, because Rogue One opened in China over the weekend, but in some of the more urban areas, there were a haze or a smog alert.
Oh, so it was bad weather conditions for people to go out.
Right. So the question was, would the pollution problem in Beijing and other areas actually cause a dent in the box office? It doesn't look like it did.
Well, it didn't open as strongly as the last Star Wars movie, I think, but it opened to $32 million in China. And that's, of course, why it's number one around the world. Down at number seven, just below Hidden Figures, is another movie that's platforming well. And, of course, it had a great night at the Golden Globes. It's La La Land, $14 million over the weekend, $85 million worldwide. So that's really, a $30 million budget seems modest, but it's a musical, a classic original, typical musical. And that has not done that well at the box office over the years. Getting to $100 million and more than tripling your budget is a big accomplishment, and they're just getting going. And number eight is Underworld Blood Wars, $13 million over the weekend, $60 million worldwide. And number nine is the James Franco, Bryan Cranston comedy, Why Him?, $12 million over the weekend, $75 million worldwide. And number 10, the Zhang Zhimu film, The Great Wall, starring Matt Damon, $12 million over the weekend, $180 million worldwide, but it cost $150 million to make. So this sucker really needs to make money outside of China in order to hit profitability.
Well, it hasn't opened up in the U.S. yet, or Canada, or most of Latin America, if not all of Latin America.
Oh, it's got ways to go. It's only in 20 territories, so it has a ways to go. But it does need, when you're betting $150 million, you got to make money outside your home territory most of the time. That's true in China, and it's usually true in the U.S. And number 11 is the Chinese romantic comedy Some Like It Hot, even though it's not a remake of that classic Hollywood film. $11 million over the weekend, $50 million in total. At number 12, Will Smith's quiet little drama, Collateral Beauty, not doing so well. $8 million over the weekend, $60 million worldwide. At number 13, also making $7 million, is Fantastic Beasts, which is just about to pass the $800 million mark. And at number 14 is Your Name, the Japanese animated film that we've been talking about for a while. $7 million over the weekend. Isn't it more than $100 million worldwide? I don't know if that world total is accurate.
Well, it's 102 at least.
I thought it was more than 102, though. And at number 15, the Jackie Chan movie, another $5 million from that. A couple new movies lower on the list. There's like 20 or 30 or, you know, 40 movies sometimes on the worldwide list. We like to focus in on the ones that are new to us and see what they are. One of those is Viking. This is a Russian epic called the Russian Game of Thrones, even though it's historical based and not fantasy based. It's a saga about a Russian prince being kicked out of his home, pairing up with the Vikings to go back and take power again. It made $5 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on a Wednesday, maybe, because it's at just about $10 million. It stars Danila Kozlovsky and Svetlana Kurchenkova, and it's already been turned into a theme park. They took the sets from the movie and they set them up in some town somewhere. So it's not a hugely elaborate theme park, but by God, it is. They've got the sets and things ready. If the movie clicks, people will have a place they can go to and play around on the actual stuff that they made the movie with. And looking down, number 21.
This is sort of interesting. I knew it. I was like, oh, I wish I could place a bet on this because I have a feeling he's going to mention number 21.
And well, we don't always get numbers on this, but Met Opera often does live performances in theaters around the country and around the world. In 9 territories, they played Met Opera Nabucco, the Verdi opera with Placido Domingo, $4.1 million worldwide in a one-night performance. They'll probably do a rerun in a few days, but that's a good little bit of change, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, it costs money to film it, but then they show it on PBS, they release it on Blu-ray, and now they do the live performance in movie theaters, and they grossed $4 million. So you have the expense of doing it, but you get to use it in multiple ways, and you build up a library of opera performances. That's a good, valuable addition to your company's bottom line. And they probably maybe netted half a million out of this, all said and done. So that's pretty good when you're talking about the budget of an opera. It's nice to have an extra $1 million to shave off that cost.
Yeah, and Peter Gelb has certainly been given a lot of grief over this whole thing. Well, really, he's been given grief over the operating budget of the Met itself. He is the head of the Met. But years from now, you know, I think we're going to look back on this time period and have all of this media that we can refer to for Pavarotti and Netrebko and all of these musicians and opera singers.
Conductors, yeah.
Yeah, that we do not have for opera singers and artists of the past.
And nowadays, really, when you're talking about opera sales, people don't buy opera audio CDs. They just buy the Blu-rays. They want to see the production. So that's really just when you look at opera lovers, they don't buy audio cassettes anymore. They don't buy, audio versions of operas. They want the visual. And that's just sort of a common now. So that's sort of an interesting sea change for fans of opera. But I think that's pretty typical these days. Looking down lower, the two other movies are new. One is another Russian film. It's an animated movie called Three Heroes and the Sea King. It's the third in a series based on folk tales about the three heroes. They're, in this case, fighting the Sea King. $3 million over the weekend, $5 million total. And then in Italy, just like Verdi's opera, Italy is where that one is set, is Mr. Felicita. It's the latest from writer, director, and star Alessandro Siani. And his sister, apparently, of his character gets sick, so he has to sub for her at this psychiatrist's office. He's just the cleaner. The guy cleans up, but then the psychiatrist goes on vacation, and he suddenly, for some reason, pretends to be the assistant, and obviously suddenly he starts giving advice to people who need help in therapy. If that sounds promising to you, go check out Mumford by Lawrence Kasdan, a nice little film that I quite like and like to champion because people sort of forgot about it. But Mr. Felicita is open in Italy right now, $3 million over the weekend, $7 million and counting.
This sounds like a good movie for a remake.
Well, that they could be, they could remake it. Absolutely. Before we move on to all the awards ceremonies, I wanted to talk about an article by Kim Masters in the Hollywood Reporter. I worked with her at Premiere Magazine, though I'm sure she has no idea who I am. I was just a lowly fact checker. But
well, that was some time ago. That was like in the late 80s, early 90s.
Hush. No, it was in the 90s, actually. Okay. Not in the 80s. I was in college in the 80s. I'm not as old as you are. But anyway, she had a story about the major studios and the problems they face. And one thing she said, and I wonder about this, she says, quote, "The studios, except for Disney, are dead serious about collapsing theatrical windows and getting a premium price for home viewing of movies that might still be playing in theaters," end quote. She says, everybody wants this other than Disney. And they've talked about it for years. But do they really want it for big hit new films? Are they dying to do this with Fantastic Beasts and Rogue One is Disney. But are they dying to do it with Fantastic Beasts and Hidden Figures and big rolls of the dice like that and Passengers? Or are they looking to do it only for movies that are flopping?
Well, I think they're looking to do it, period. I mean, I think they're looking to experiment. And, you know, it's... they're going to get burned by this, I think.
So you do think they would say, I do want to try and have like a big movie like Fantastic Beasts, a movie we're excited by, and say, let's do it right away as soon as possible, as opposed to saying, I want this outlet so we can go quickly to, you know, streaming or collapse of window when the movie's done. It's played out. Why wait 3 months for a movie that flopped? Let's get it into people's homes as soon as possible to hope that we can get extra coin and play off the advertising we had. They're already 12 weeks later coming into your home anyway, but they just want to do that quicker. But you think they want to do it even with big movies that they're really high on? They want to do it with a Marvel movie. They want to do it with a Tarzan movie or a King Kong movie.
Well, okay. Not Marvel, because that's
right,
Disney.
That's Disney. I'm just saying in general, that type of movie.
Well, I think a Tarzan, that's a perfect example. A movie that's a big budget movie that they touted, you know, for months on end, and then it is released and does nothing. I mean, it immediately collapses. That is one where, you know, 3 weeks later, they probably...
makes sense to us. Yeah,
yeah, it might make sense. And frankly, and this is a bit of a... I don't want to say a non sequitur. It's kind of a tributary to your comment. I went to see La La Land over the weekend, mm-hmm. and I went to my local theater. And this is something that it's kind of a general pet peeve that I think others can buy into. The wider population can buy into, which is, you know, it's a sixplex in my neighborhood. It's one where one of the theaters actually was the first. Barco Oro, you know, the big giant surround sound object based audio, you know, 11 speakers. Mm-hmm. La La Land was showing in a smaller auditorium. And when I got there, there were two, I don't know whether they were teenagers or, you know, between 17 and 20 year olds. And they were sitting kind of down the row from me and they were talking nonstop through the pre-show, which is fine. Nonstop through all the trailers. Okay, fine.
Less fine.
Yeah. And then throughout the opening number, which is a musical number, and I finally said, okay, I can control this. I can just tell them to please be quiet, which I did, and they were quiet. But what bothered me more was the fact that the picture that was being presented to me was dark. There was no contrast, and it was actually dark. And that's because, more than likely, the movie theater turned the bulb down, so turn the brightness down
to save money
on the actual bulbs. These bulbs cost a lot of money and they need to be replaced fairly often, maybe 3, 4, 5 times a year if you're projecting properly, maybe even more. And there were times where certain characters in that opening sequence, which is out in broad daylight, okay, this is a sequence that takes place on a freeway, and it looked dark. And noticeably dark, to a point where later in the evening when I was watching the Golden Globes and they had shots from that very scene, it popped. Those scenes on my television popped. So where am I going with all of this? What I'm saying is movie theater owners aren't doing themselves any favors. Because mm-hmm. frankly, my 4K television at home has a better picture and is more convenient.
And more true to what the filmmaker wants you to see.
Correct. That's really where I was headed with that. Is I am sure if Damien Chazelle could see his film in that theater, he would cry.
Well, for a while, the studios fought back, or at least artists did, by like having the THX system where you had to meet certain standards in order to get stamped a THX certified movie theater so you had decent picture and sound. Can't studios send people in and go, the light level is not enough here. You're screwing over the movie. You can't do this. Can't they fight back and demand certain levels of quality?
I think they probably can. That's a good question. I don't know whether they can or not. I mean, sure, I'm sure they can by saying, okay, well, we're not sending you this movie because we know it's not going to be projected properly. But you would
think,
you're
not projecting our movies properly. You're not showing them well. Right. So you need to stop.
Right. And I guess, look, call me golden eyes, okay? I might be the one out of 1,000 people that understands why the film doesn't look right or why you just don't feel like, eh.
But it's less satisfying.
It's less satisfying overall. And I would say a majority, if not most, of the people leaving that auditorium wouldn't necessarily know why they kind of were like, you know, semi-satisfied but not overly satisfied with the film. And it has to do with story and acting and music and all of that, but also the experience. And that experience is becoming less and less valuable.
You find that a lot all the time?
Especially with some of the big chains, because they have every screen is a silver screen, so that means the skin tones are grayer and the contrast is off and the light, you know, they've all dimmed their bulbs so that the brightness isn't there. It's a real problem.
And speaking of La La Land, is that the sort of movie you would want to do in people's homes right away? Because again, that seems like a movie where La La Land and Hidden Figures are going to be a lot more valuable down the road if you get people to go to the movies and talk about it and experience with other people. Do you want to cash out and cut that off at the knees by letting it be available in the home like a week after it opens? I wouldn't.
No, although I would say this right now about Moonlight. Okay, I would love to see Moonlight. I didn't get to see it at its press screenings. I didn't get to see it when it was in theaters. And
isn't it still in theaters?
It's in like three theaters in Los Angeles, and it's very difficult to find, not only in LA, but in other places as well. And so I looked up, I said, okay, not that I'd want to do this, but when is it being released on DVD? Okay, February 28th after the Oscars. Now, this is a film where it's already been out now for what, like, 8-9 weeks.
It's on 135 screens right now, and I'm sure they'll bring it back out to more screens when it gets Oscar nominations.
I certainly hope they do.
Yeah.
Because I would go see it.
Well, speaking of what movies people are going to go see, it helps them when they get end of the year honors like Oscars or Golden Globes or a Writer Guild nomination. Most people aren't going to rush out to the theater because a movie wins that, but this is certainly a good indicator of who's going to be in place to win an Oscar, because the Writer Guild members, a lot of them are Oscar members, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And do you want me to kind of list the original screenplay nominees?
Sure. Who's in the fight? Who's in the mix?
Well, I'm not going to necessarily list the screenwriters, although I should.
No. Just the movies. That's okay.
Okay. So for original,
They're used to being ignored.
Yeah, exactly. Hell or High Water for original screenplay. La La Land. Loving. Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan, of course, wrote that one, and Moonlight. So actually, for this one, this is actually a really good horse race, because you got Manchester by the Sea, you got Moonlight, and you got La La Land. And all of those could, either one of them, you could see winning and kind of people being very pleased.
An adapted screenplay is Arrival, Deadpool, Fences, Hidden Figures, and Nocturnal Animals, which was a surprise winner for Best Supporting Actor. Boy, did I not like that movie. But I could easily see these 10 films being the 10 Oscar nominees for screenplay in original and adapted as well.
I agree, yeah.
So they're right in the mix there. What about the National Society of Film Critics? Were they able to clear things up? It seems like you've got Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea and La La Land, with maybe Hidden Figures as a dark horse coming up on the side, as competitors for that top prize. What did the National Society of Film Critics say?
The National Society of Film Critics went with, drumroll please, Moonlight.
And the runner-ups were Manchester by the Sea and La La Land.
That's right.
So this is definitely a year where you've got a love spread around a couple of different movies. There's no clear one winner, but you've got at least three movies that are going to be, you know, punching it out for the Best Picture Oscar.
Well, and just remember, La La Land, let's say, much like the Golden Globes, it could win everything. Absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to Best Picture, because of the way they do their voting, which is this cockamamie system, Moonlight could win, or Manchester by the Sea could win, because more people will say, well, I like Moonlight number one, Manchester by the Sea number two, or Manchester by the Sea number one, La La Land number two, and Moonlight number three, or vice versa. So, you know, because they basically do it, it's a weighted average.
You have a problem with that?
I just think, you know what? Pick the best picture.
Well, they are.
Yeah, I don't know why I don't like this weighted average. It's just, there's something about it, something very electoral college-y about it.
Yeah, so there weren't a lot of surprises at the National Society of Film Critics. They seem to be, we've got a lot of clear front runners. And when you look at who won the prize, like Casey Affleck for Best Actor, then the runner-ups were Denzel Washington and Adam Driver. Isabelle Huppert won Best Actress, Annette Bening, and, well, here's a bit of a side one, Sandra Hüller for Tony Erdmann. She's certainly a deserving nominee. Whether she'll get an Oscar nomination, of course, is very difficult to say. Isabelle Huppert is certainly looking like she'll get one for Elle. She's certainly in the running. So again, not a lot of clarification there. A lot of the same people are in the mix. And I think we saw the same thing at the Tony Awards. I mean, at the Tony Awards, at the Golden Globes, didn't we?
Yeah. I mean, so I guess you want to get into the Golden Globes. Is that...
Very briefly.
Okay, yeah.
I didn't watch it because I heard the teleprompter broke. Jimmy Fallon wasn't funny. Meryl Streep took on Donald Trump without calling him out by name. I always think of the Golden Globes as the practice your Oscar acceptance speech night.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this in the past where you probably can't win an Academy Award because you won a Golden Globe. That's kind of not really the way it works. They're not necessarily a great predictor, but you could really lose an Academy Award by kind of botching your speech at the Golden Globes, because that is the true national kickoff, if you will, for the Oscar race.
That's right. So La La Land swept up and did really well, but you know what? La La Land won Best Musical or Comedy. Moonlight won Best Drama. And then right away, there's Casey Affleck in the mix again. I mean, so it's a real horse race among these movies. In foreign film, was it L1 and Zootopia won Best Animated Movie? These are all the nominees that we're going to expect to see come Oscar time. You know, Emma Stone, Aaron Taylor Johnson beat out Mahershala Ali. Is that how you say his name?
Yes.
For Moonlight, who deserves to win. He's terrific. Viola Davis. So it's all the people that you would expect to see come Oscar time in the mix. I think in the television is where they kind of showed their usual quirky Golden Globes taste, naming The Crown Best Drama, Atlanta Best Comedy. That showed some fresh faces that they wanted to bring in, and that's what the Golden Globes likes to do.
Well, they also kind of decided this year not to name The Martian Best Comedy or some drama Best Comedy so that they get the movie star there.
They got about 19 million people were watching the Golden Globes, up a tick from last year and the year before. They're using their platform to tout some television that didn't get as much attention as it should have. My favorite moment that I saw in clips was when Rachel Bloom, she's up for Best Actress in a TV Comedy, and she's always eating on her show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which just got renewed for season 3, by the way. That was a shocker to me. I thought it was going to be canceled. But when they said, and up for Best Actress, Rachel Bloom, they cut to her, and she's eating food in her seat at the Golden Globes because she is always eating on the show. She just mercilessly makes fun of herself. So I liked seeing that.
But, and I have to say, if you have not seen this show, and I don't know if you've ever been to West Covina, California, Michael, but it is...
I didn't even know it was a real place.
Yeah, it is. And it's very accurately portrayed. It's very funny. I stumbled across this show, I think it was on Netflix, and I was like, oh, I'll watch an episode or two, or all of a sudden, I'm on like episode 9 and 10, and I'm like, oh my God, the second season isn't on Netflix yet. What am I going to do? And so I am really glad that this TV show was picked up. And I urge you to watch it. It may not be for everybody, but it's certainly very kind of commercially appealing, so to speak.
Yeah, it's not a hard watch. Season 1 was a lot of fun. It had some problems. Season 2 has been not good creatively. I'm still happy it got picked up for a third season, but there's been a number of issues and cast changes and stuff that were sort of hard to deal with and unavoidable. The show sort of lost its way, but I still kind of like it.
Well, and I did notice that she kind of waited for her name to be called, the lead actress. And as soon as her name was called and she knew the camera was on her, she popped something into her mouth. I didn't notice that, too.
Yeah, she's always eating. It's hilarious on the show.
Yeah, well, and I laughed at people said, well, why are you laughing? I thought, it's an inside joke.
Exactly.
You got to watch the show. I mean, there's not really much more to say, though, about the Golden Globes, is there?
Nope.
I mean, do you think, let me ask you this, as somebody who is, you know, a Broadway maven, you know a lot about Broadway, La La Land, this musical, this modern day musical, as everybody keeps calling it, I want to just talk about the music for a second. Because it won Best Song and it won Best Score. Do you think that's going to carry over to the Academy Awards?
Well, it's a musical. It's going to be a big contender for Best Song and Best Score, no question about it. I don't really think the music is that good. I thought some of the guys behind it did a better job with the score for Dear Evan Hansen, the musical that they have that just opened on Broadway and will be a competitor for Best Musical come Tony time in June. They could win Oscars for one musical and a Tony for another musical in the same year. I don't know if that's ever happened before, but that'll be, that's what's going to happen. But yeah, because it's a musical, people will obviously gravitate to that show.
Well, okay. The reason I wanted to know about song is because, of course, there's some talk of Lin-Manuel Miranda being nominated for his song in Moana.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody thought, well, he's going to win because, you know, he's on that run. He's on that tear right now. Everybody loves him. He's going to win. But I don't know.
No, that's not a given at all. I mean, it's not a big song. It's not a song that's well known. It's a fine song and a fine movie. But La La Land is the darling of the moment. And, he's won everything in sight already. He doesn't need to win this as well. He's got a lot of other movie projects in the works. He certainly could win, of course. Anybody who gets nominated could win. But it's certainly not a given by any stretch of the imagination.
Nor is the nomination, so.
Well, I'll be shocked if he doesn't get a nomination. I imagine he will.
Well, okay. I guess that really does wrap up our Golden Globes coverage, which is probably more time than we should have spent on it. But it moves us along into our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And Michael, each week you pick, you know, from thousands of books, you pick the book that you've selected as some of your top picks. And frankly, we've kind of transitioned this to be a book that you think should be adapted to movies or television.
That's right. It'd be a good property for stage, television, you know, who knows, maybe even video games. That's sort of what we've pulled into here. But it's the same pick this week. My number one book of the week is also one that I think probably already has been optioned. It's called The Bear and the Nightingale by Catherine Arden. It's a debut fantasy novel. Last year, one of the big books of the year was Naomi Novik's Uprooted. Actually, that was 2 years ago, I think, 2015. A very good book based on Polish folk tales with a plucky young heroine. It was a terrific book, a huge bestseller. And I think if you liked that book, you'll really like this one. It's set in Russia. It's sort of set in the real world of Russia in the 1800s or the 1700s. And it's about Vasya, this spirited young girl. And she's on the verge of becoming a woman. And she sees spirits. There are all these folk tales about, like, the spirit that lives in the fireplace or the spirit that lives in the barn and watches over the horses. And they're not just folktales. She actually sees these creatures and is friends with them. And so does her new stepmother. But her stepmother thinks these are devils and that she's going crazy. And it leads to a fierce battle of wills. It's all about abandoning the old ways and becoming more modern and what you lose track of. It starts out very real. And it gets more and more magical as it goes along. I really liked this book a lot. It's a really strong debut.
Is it for kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, could a 10-year-old read
this? It's a young adult book. It's not for little kids. There's nothing, you know, explicit or violent there's scary stuff and creatures and marriage and things, but it's not for little children.
No, not 6-year-olds.
Young adults. Anybody who read Harry Potter would probably be fine with it. But it's really a fantasy novel, you know, for people.
Well, okay. Well, I'm actually a little interested in this next book you want to tell us about.
Well, it's called A Really Good Day. It's by Ayelet Waldman, who's got a lot of attention once when she said she loved her husband more than she loved her children. She said, am I a bad parent for loving my husband more than my kids? Because he comes first. And that got all sorts of attention. She ended up writing a book on that. But she's battled with depression and other issues in her life. And she started to experiment with microdosing LSD. She explored it very thoroughly. She looked up a lot of information. She got a package of LSD anonymously in the mail and then had it tested to make sure it was clean and, you know, what it was. And then she started following this regimen that people people do of microdosing. It's an amount so small that you wouldn't think it would have an effect, but it does. And she wrote a diary about it. She says it helped save her marriage. And she also mixes in her diary entries with a history of LSD and drug testing and the clampdown on it. Because in the 60s and 50s, it was really being widely tested and finding positive results. And now that stuff is happening again. It's not available for regular use like marijuana is, but it's kind of crazy and nutty. And she talks about like day one, day two, day three, and the cycle she goes through and what effect it has on her mood and fighting with her husband. It's kind of fascinating.
Of course, she thinks she's married to Brad Pitt, but that could be the drugs.
That's right.
You know, I saw the description of this book and I thought, microdosing. Okay, that's kind of interesting. I love your description. She gets some LSD in the mail. You know, I get bills in my mail. I don't know about her, but
I just got some packages. Maybe there's some LSD in there. Who knows?
It's like, what, did it just show up?
Yeah.
I'd like to test my bills and make sure they're real. But
sadly, they are.
Yeah. Did you read this story? And I think it was in the Daily Beast. Of a reporter who was at the Consumer Electronics Show over the past week, and she decided to report on LSD. So she took LSD for the very first time and then
what?
Went to
I did not read this.
The CES, which if you've ever been to CES, just walking into those halls, you know, there's like 150,000 people there and every TV in the world, all those screens and robots and, you know, drones and everything. Frankly, you don't need LSD to think that you're tripping. Okay, it's that kind of overstimulating. And so it did not go well for her.
Well, to clarify, when you're microdosing, and it's obviously something people shouldn't do on their own lackadaisically, it's not like going on a trip. It is a very like 1/100th of what you get in a regular dose of what's considered a typical dose of LSD for a trip, which is itself a very small amount. So microdosing really is micro, and it does not send you on a hallucinogenic trip. There are lots of therapeutic uses for this for people who are dealing with cancer and end of life issues. They're experimenting and doing tests with this now under controlled conditions. And it is really kind of interesting. People dealing with depression or, you know, major issues. And they're finding there's a lot of benefits that might be found from this in a properly done way.
That would be kind of interesting if LSD became a therapeutic drug.
If it did, it would be a big deal.
Oh, okay. Well, if LSD kind of becoming, well, legalized in a way is a big deal. I wonder if what you'll think about some of our news stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is, well, it's really just about me canceling my cable subscription finally because I will, you know, first off, Dish, the cable, well, it's a satellite provider. They are going to do an over-the-top network with Sling. So they're going to do what's like an under $40, you know, bundle.
Well, I don't know what their total amount is not clear yet.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right.
But Hulu, they say plans, they can provide over-the-air networks with no retransmission fee.
Okay.
I think they get you to set up like an antenna. You have to buy an antenna and you set it up and then you can get the digital signal and that will mix into their Sling guide. I think that's their plan.
Okay. Yeah. Aereo had a fun time doing that. Hulu, on the other hand, does have an under $40 TV bundle coming and now they have CBS. So that's why I'm cutting my cable cord.
So they've got all four major networks.
Correct.
And it'll be under $40, and there will be a cloud DVR, so you can tape things. And that's not their promotional price. That's the price that they say they expect to offer long term. So this is really happening now. When one of these happens, you've got all four networks, then you're talking about a skinny bundle that might really tempt people to cut off their cable bill, right?
Yes, and you will see the collapse of the television industry.
Right, because they don't have the money coming in the same?
Yes, correct. I mean, all of a sudden, me who watches ESPN, well, okay, I do watch ESPN, but I don't watch ESPN Español or like all of the, or Deportes or, you know, ESPN 90, you know, the 90th channel of ESPN. And so those will all go away because I'm paying for it right now.
Right, but those are cheap to maintain, right? I mean, as far as...
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Okay, well, actually, maybe we can talk about TV's number one show, because number one is still number one. So Sunday Night Football is the major network's number one show on television. even though its ratings are down 10% from the previous season. That's not so bad since the show's audience seemed to be collapsing early on. Some big games picked it up, you know, at the end of the season, with the final average being almost exactly 20 million viewers. It's also number one in the key 18 to 49 demo, but that's also where football took its biggest hit, dropping 15% compared to 1 year earlier. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? It's the number one show. You can say, oh, it's down from previously. It's like, yeah. It doesn't mean it'll be number one forever, but it's still number one. That's pretty darn good. But are they losing young people? That's what movies are worried about, aren't they? They're worried young people are losing. They've always been worried that young people will lose the habit of going to the movies. There's some data to back that up. Is that happening with TV's number one show? Are they not watching sports the way kids used to do in the past?
Yeah, I mean, my kids, you know, they'll watch sports, but they don't always know what's on, you know. But then, you know, I have two girls, so.
Well, the girls like sports, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Sexist dad.
No, I mean, I'm not sitting there like, you know, my nephew at the age of seven knows, you know, everything about football and you know, starts calling, you know, penalties while he's watching television. Whereas, you know, I don't necessarily know that my daughters, you know, I don't sit there watching football with them, so they might not really cotton to it.
Because your nephew has an adult there watching the games.
Right, exactly.
Right. But do you think millennials are tuning out of sports the way the Hollywood is worried they might be tuning out movies?
Possibly. Certainly because of the expense of going to, you know, a baseball game or a football game. It's pretty pricey these days.
Yeah.
Apple, by the way, has always said it can and must abide by local laws. But doing that often means collaborating with censorship and totalitarian states. It's a no-win of bad PR, and it's happened again. Apple agreed to a Chinese request to remove the apps for the New York Times from its store in that country. Just the latest clampdown on outside information, and especially the Times, by the Communist Party rulers in China. Apple said they had no choice. Outside observers say that, one, they should never agree to a government ruling without at least insisting on knowing what law is being violated, and two, they say Apple should also loudly complain and drag their feet when doing so. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, unfortunately. People will forget about it in a day. One empathizes a little bit with Apple, I guess. There's no good answer to this. But yeah, they were told, oh, you're breaking the law. They're like, okay. They're like, well, what law? Like, they can't even tell them what law they're in violation of. I guess it doesn't matter in the end result. But you can at least say, well, you have to tell me what law I'm in violation of. Can you show me the law? You know, they could at least put up a little bit of a fuss, and they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, look, China is a very difficult place to do business. And I think businesses from throughout the world are figuring that out. McDonald's just today decided they're not getting out of China, but they're basically selling off their Chinese business. And they will be part owner in the business, but they will franchise out everything. And a company that is owned by the state will take over 52% of the company in China for McDonald's.
Why did they decide that?
Because it's really difficult to do business in China with all
and
of these regulations.
So they say, you do business and we'll just take the money.
Correct. Exactly.
And is that the moral ethical decision that one should make?
Well, and in Apple's defense, because they pointed this out themselves, is look, we had to do this because they're, you know, they obviously did look into the laws that were being broken. And by the way, you know what else
Well, no, they didn't. That was a big complaint that they didn't. They were told you're in violation of a law and they said, okay, and they removed the app. That was a big problem. They don't know what law they're in violation. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what law they broke.
Well, they also at the same time had to remove two other apps, one for their own movie store and one for their bookstore.
Right.
So
I guess I thought those went out earlier. I guess the question is, should you be doing business in a country like, you know, whatever, you know, totalitarian country you want to talk about? Is it ethical and moral? Should you be making money there if you cannot maintain the standards and values that your company is supposed to represent?
Yeah, well, that's always been the question with well, not only China, but, you know, many countries.
Of course, South Africa, when it was an apartheid state, Israel and Palestine, people have questions about that all the time. They're, you know, Cuba, when you have dictators there, you know, what countries should you do business with? Does you just say, oh, I'll do business with them all if I can make money? That's the issue, not whether this or that rule was broken. Okay, Apple sold off their business. Yeah, they're still profiting from the McDonald's in China. So they're not really, they're just wiping their hands up and saying, oh, we're just taking the money.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, they have no control of the brand. I wonder how much control of the brand they'll have.
Yeah, well, they must have some or they'd be idiots.
But think about it this way. You know, Wanda comes in and purchases AMC 100% or, you know, most of it and the controlling share of it. And there's no pushback. There's no, you know, they're allowed to do that.
Well, they should be.
If an American company or a European company tried to do the same in China, it would be very difficult, if not impossible.
Right. And they should be allowed to do business.
Correct.
And that's why you have trade organizations and groups and you push for the same rules of law all across the, you know, the world so that businesses operate on a level playing field, et cetera.
Right. And no, I mean, I think we're vehemently agreeing with one another again.
Mm.
I wonder how we'll do on this next story, because Norway is getting rid of FM radio. Most citizens don't want it to disappear, but the government is going ahead anyway with the switch to all digital radio. The biggest obstacle, of course, are car radios and the cost of switching over for those who haven't switched over already. But digital is ideally suited to reaching people in the complex terrain of Norway with its mountains and fjords. Plus, digital provides a clearer signal. And now the government can forego the cost of maintaining dual systems. The shutdown starts January 11th and will continue station by station throughout the year. Switzerland is doing a similar shutdown by 2020, and the UK and Denmark are mulling the move as well, with the UK studying the issue as soon as digital listening reaches 50% of all listeners. This is a target that should be reached sometime this year. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? It's going to happen all over the world. It's just a matter of time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in Norway, one of the issues is the curvature of the earth and, you know, FM signals kind of curving around. So there's a technical reason as well.
Doesn't the earth curve in California?
Yeah, they're very far north. So
okay.
there are some issues with that, you know, not necessarily ones that couldn't be overcome. They were overcome for over 100 years. So it's, you know, they just don't want dual systems. And oh, by the way, they can also auction off all that FM spectrum for other uses.
There you go.
So now I would not want to be Tucker Carlson right now. Sure, you get a choice primetime slot on Fox News, the number one 24-hour news channel, heck, the number one cable channel in primetime, period, including ESPN. But what guy wants to hear the jokes about being a poor substitute for Megyn Kelly? Kelly has grown tremendously as an interviewer and TV host and debate moderator in the last few years, putting others like Matt Lauer in her rearview mirror. Tucker Carlson? Well, not so fast. He does have a story to tell. Carlson took over the 7 p.m. slot right as the election peaked, and he has been the number two ranked cable news show in the 25 to 54 demo, right behind Bill O'Reilly and ahead of Kelly. He also is doing good numbers for Fox News in the 18 to 49 demo. Will the aging Fox News audience mind the all-male, all-white, all-Trump nature of their primetime lineup? Yeah, is that a rhetorical question or how to, anyway, Carlson has been on all three cable news channels, so he might have more reach to new viewers who've seen him on CNN and MSNBC. But Fox News has typically flourished with the White House as their enemy, not as their friend. Time will tell, but as an opening move to shore up their prime time while under attack from CNN, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, people sort of poo-poo, oh, what a joke. But, you know, his numbers are pretty good. He's been doing well in the 7 o'clock time slot, so don't be so quick. And, you think, it's all male, all white lineup. Yeah, Fox News, it'll be all right. Maybe that's going to work okay for them. It's not going to make them younger or move them in the direction perhaps the younger Murdochs wanted to go. But it will work short term, I think, better than people expect. It's been sort of a big musical chairs thing going on. Greta Van Susteren has gone to MSNBC. Megyn Kelly has gone to NBC. And Tucker Carlson has now moved up into the primetime slot that anybody would want. So we'll have to see where it ends up. But I think short term, it's going to do better than you think.
And just for those of you who are in charge of Fox News, Michael and I are free to take over the 7 o'clock slot.
Absolutely.
Love, by the way, Michael, trumps hate.
Well, does it?
Yeah, well, maybe, but hate sells, okay? That's one explanation for why Simon & Schuster paid a $250,000 advance to far-right leader of the racist alt-right movement, Milo Yiannopoulos, for an upcoming memoir. Milo is the openly gay far-right agitator who was so toxic online, he was actually banned from Twitter. Believe me, that's not easy to do.
They don't ban people very readily.
No, and, you know, there are some world leaders that should probably be banned from Twitter. Countless people complained that Simon & Schuster was giving big bucks and a huge megaphone to a hate monger. Simon & Schuster and a notable number of free speech advocates said the book industry can and should publish an array of voices, and maybe people should wait and actually read the memoir before objecting to it. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it was a big deal in the publishing industry. It really created a shockwave. People were like, what? They're very, very angry. Simon & Schuster authors were angry. Authors at other imprints were angry. People were calling them out. Publishers publish a lot of conservative books. There are conservative imprints. They reach out to a conservative audience. This happens all the time. You've got Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and people with some ugly points of view that reach a big audience and get published. I think Milo Yiannopoulos, is that how you say his name?
Milo.
Yiannopoulos?
Yeah.
Is a little different because people don't see him as like a conservative figure. They see him as a hate monger.
No.
So it's like, yes, he deserves free speech, but no, you don't have to give him $250,000. And publish his book. Someone else can do that.
Especially when the guy is basically saying, yeah, I know I'm controversial and I breed hate. That's kind of my
shtick. That's my thing.
Yeah.
That's my jam.
And I hate you too. So stop asking me these questions. Yeah, I mean, he's just definitely one of those people where you're like, wow, okay, yeah, I don't necessarily need you in my life.
Yeah, but it was a big week in publishing, and that was probably the biggest news, though Amazon did mention a couple more stores they're opening, including one in Manhattan, another one in Jersey. They're going to have 8 by the end of this year, Amazon bookstores in America. And Barnes & Noble, same store sales were down in the holiday period. So more bad news for Barnes & Noble.
If same store sales were down this year at Barnes & Noble, then why did it take so long in that gift wrapping line, for Pete's sake? Everyone in TV wants a new standardized measurement that can show how many people are watching TV shows, whether it's on live TV, DVR, streaming, on demand, a network's website, a third-party site like Hulu, and so on. But guess what? It ain't easy. Nielsen believes it's close with the new total audience measurement metric, but NBC and others raised concerns about the methodology and results, meaning they got the results, didn't like them, and decided to raise some questions. So Nielsen has delayed its launch and will continue the testing and sharing the results as they fiddle with the mix. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you say that, and it's a fair enough complaint. Oh, NBC just didn't like what the new information said. But it is tricky to try to balance out all these different platforms and say, well, if you watch 51% of a TV show in streaming, does that mean you've watched the entire show? Does that count as a view? What about 10%? What about 30%? There's a lot of questions to answer, isn't there?
There absolutely are.
However, I would also point out that you look at like SoundScan, which measures the music industry. They fiddle with their formula pretty regularly as far as what the biggest hits in music are right now. You look at singles. Well, they say, well, how much should count for streaming? How much should count for online on demand viewing? How much should count for over the air radio play? How much should come out for sales? And they fiddle with that as viewership patterns change because they want to reflect how people are consuming music. I think you're going to see the same thing in this measurement, that it's not going to be a fixed set formula that's done forever. It's going to be a lot more fiddling than we're used to. I think 6 months, a year down the road, they'll say, well, now, wait a second. Now this is happening. We got to reflect this.
Yeah, and I wonder with all of the whole licensing to streaming music, okay, you know, the artists, for the most part, and I know that new artists, these deals are not cut the same way, but Eminem proved that older deals, you get 50% of licensing, right?
Right, right. Well, that's a big issue, yeah.
Yeah, and so all of a sudden SoundScan is saying, well, if it's streamed 150 times and that's like one sale, and so now they're kind of slowly moving it more towards a sales-driven mentality. I think maybe in part to get the mentality away from licensing.
Yeah, I'm sure. And of course, we've said in music that they really should not count a stream as a sale.
Yeah.
It's just a different thing. Just tell us how often it's streamed. Just list the top stream songs of the week.
Right.
Don't pretend it's a sale. It's not.
No, celluloid isn't making a comeback. But Kodak did just announce it would begin production again on Ektachrome, its premium line of film for photographers. They credited steadily increasing sales of 35mm film and a surge of interest in analog photography by professionals and amateurs alike. Ektachrome will hit shelves by the end of 2017. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I wish there was more info as far as whether it's a big deal or not. I mean, how much are they putting in production? Did they open up a factory in the U.S. or overseas? What's their, you know, is this like a modest little thing or is this a significant comeback? I don't really know. I just know Paul Simon must be furious.
Why? That it's not Kodachrome?
Right, yeah, he picked the wrong name. Mama don't take my Ektachrome. Mama don't take, you know, he's like, damn it, it was so close. Oh, well.
Well, you know, look, professional photographers still often use film, especially with large formats. So if you're shooting a 4x5 or, you know, 120, 220, you're often shooting a large format, you know, film.
Yes, there's a big demand from professionals, but I think really this must be amateurs that are really powering this because that's where the numbers are. So I'm imagining that there were a lot of amateur people who say, you know what? I like film. You know, the sort of getting back into creating a print and doing that sort of thing just to make it worthwhile for Kodak.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is my kids got these like Fuji Polaroid, you know, Instamax cameras for the holidays. And, you know, they had, I kind of had to explain to them, look, this is not a phone camera. Okay. You can't just take like 50 photos just because you feel like it. There's actually only 14 photos in this packet. And the next packet costs like $15. So it's like a dollar a photo.
I think the being able to take lots of digital pictures is really cool though, and kids being able to shoot, you know, video and film and take pictures endlessly, like you say, without having to worry about it because it's digital. I think that's awesome. I think that's a really cool thing. But I know Apple just mentioned that they've added something to their iPhone. It's called the theater mode, isn't it?
That's right.
What the heck? I don't get this.
I don't get it either.
This thing called theater mode, and what is it?
Basically, they're trying to keep iPhone users off their cell phones while they are in theaters.
Right, but it said something about, well, they'll dim the screen and you won't get notifications, stuff like, well, isn't that just the airplane mode? What's the difference between theater mode and airplane mode?
I think the ability to force the mode to be turned on.
Oh, you mean like if you walk into a theater, all phones will go into theater mode automatically?
Yeah, well, I think you actually have to, I'm reading now that you have to activate it yourself. And cellular
just like
function
airplane mode.
Yeah. You know, the, yeah, it's basically trying to force people to be considerate.
Right. But it seems just the same as airplane. Again, I don't understand how it's more of an advantage than the airplane mode.
Because in airplane mode, there is no cellular signal at all. You can't get notified at all. Whereas, you know, if you're a parent and you have a kid at home with the babysitter, you might want to keep your phone on to, you know, in case something happens.
But then people will be using their phones. Just like, what's the?
Yeah,
it's like, okay,
yeah,
all right,
yeah.
I don't get it. It's like either you know, if you're a doctor, okay, but you know, all right.
Are you trying to say that this may be a solution in search of a problem?
Yes.
Okay. For a few minutes, it seemed Conan O'Brien's talk show on TBS would switch from 4 days a week to just one. Was TBS losing faith in its ginger-haired savior? Not exactly. No changes are imminent in the show's schedule, but it's not for lack of talking. Like other talk show hosts, Conan has a major online component, and that just keeps growing. He's taken the show on the road, on road trips, and done viral videos that get tens of millions of views. He has tons of interest in his video game review segment, creates sponsored ads that are also very popular, and on and on and on, you know, carpool karaoke, that whole thing.
He doesn't do that.
I know that. That's James Corden. It all takes time, and they've been trying to figure out where his energy and focus should be. It's not happening yet, but there's a good possibility the talk show might become a weekly platform rather than a daily one, a way of sparking interest in everything else rather than the be-all, end-all. Heck, if you've got a viral video, you know, who needs a talk show? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. I think the idea and the fact that, like, hey, he's working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, creating all this content, and the Big Megillah is not the talk show.
Yeah.
That's not where the action is. That's not perhaps where the money is. And that's a big change, I think. Everybody's been doing this stuff, but making money on it and making that be your focus rather than the show itself, which is supposed to be the center of attention, that's kind of interesting.
You know, I've actually been wondering about that, about how much money could they possibly be making off of these videos that get, you know, 400, 500, 1.5, 2.5 million views. You know, how much can you make doing that? Apparently enough that it's worth maybe cutting back on their traditional media.
Because you've only got so many hours in the day. Where should your energy be? It should be on the thing that's working the most, right? I mean, his talk show doesn't get a couple million people watching. It's like a million.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you can get a sponsored video that you're making, it's not the same as having a streaming video with an ad on it. It's a sponsored video, and he can get a couple million views, and the sponsors say, awesome, people are playing my ad specifically. You're going to make a lot more money than if you have that ad just put in your talk show.
Yeah, no, I mean, now you can do service deals as well, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
And actually, this would be about the time that, Michael, that we, of course, put in an ad of our own. However, we don't have any ads, so that actually wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into our most popular segment, Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, you might think that Hollywood and religion, they're not necessarily the most natural of bedfellows. However, in a recent piece for the New York Times, Brooks Barnes explained how movie studios have been quietly courting Christian filmgoers in hopes of increasing audiences for certain movies. Mr. Barnes is a staff reporter for the New York Times who writes about Hollywood for the business, culture, and style sections. He joined us to tell us more about this marketing trend. Brooks, thank you for joining us.
Hi, of course.
Well, Brooks, now this isn't anything new. Hollywood has reached out to the religious community in various ways over the years. They have them on boards. They consult them when they're making certain movies, especially religious themed ones. What's new here seems to be that they're doing this outreach for movies that aren't overtly religious.
Right. For a very long time, they've been aware of this audience. 2000 or so is when marketers specializing in the faith community, as they call it, broadly popped up. But now they've started doing it for all kinds of movies, R-rated films. There's some horror movies, things that you would not suspect the faith crowd would be remotely interested in, but they say that it kind of depends on how you position it and how you kind of call out the various storylines.
For example, the number one movie this weekend, Hidden Figures, is a classic example. It's not a religious film particularly. There's no overt religion in it, but it does appeal to a family audience. It was able to be marketed specifically to pastors, and this was the big revelation to me. You said that the studio flew out 7 megachurch leaders onto the set of Hidden Figures so they could watch filmmaking going on and meet some of the stars. That really must have been a full court press.
That surprised me too. I wasn't invited to the sets. I know that.
I know they used to. They used to bring journalists to do set visits. That was like a big perk of being an entertainment journalist. Is you'd fly to a set, and now of course they don't do that at all for journalists.
Well, it's partly because journalists are poor and can't afford to pay their own way, mostly.
Right.
But you're right. In this case, that, to me, showed kind of how, one, aggressive they're being, two, how methodical, and I guess thinking about it far in advance, right? It's not like, okay, here's the movie, it's been delivered, now let's go try to find an audience for it. It speaks to the way that studios way, way, way earlier than they used to are laying these breadcrumbs, if you will, to various groups. And the idea, of course, is that a bunch of niches heads up into big box office as a whole on opening weekend. It whether or not that was the case for Hidden Figures, we can't really, there's no real cause and effect, in terms of statistics or data or whatever, but you have to imagine that it helped. It opened really well.
Well, how did studios run across this marketing trend? I mean, or decide, you know what, we should be doing this. We should be marketing to faith-based groups. Was it a specific movie, maybe The Passion of the Christ or some previous release where they saw that the trend worked or the that marketing to this group worked?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It was led by consultants who recognized an opportunity. There was a guy who used to be at Warner Brothers who started a company called Grace Hill in 2000, and that led to the marketing of The Blind Side with Sandra Bullock, and I'm forgetting who else part in it, but that is kind of seen as a blueprint for what you can do. They wrote sermon notes. They had ideas for people to be able to talk about the movie to their congregations, and they kind of made a direct link in that case to that audience coming out. There are a bunch of different strands that feed into it. One is that studios are having a harder time reaching people. So they can't kind of afford to overlook any audience. It's not like they ignored, conservative viewers or religious viewers completely, like we don't care about them, but they didn't feel a need to court them. Now they do. And then another thing that I didn't get into in the article, but that very much seems true, is that studios, as their business has gotten harder, have relied more heavily on consultants in that pass the buck sort of way. The more consultants you bring on, the more risk you offload if you're a marketing executive at a studio. And so I think that's part of it too.
So they can say, we left no stone unturned, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. Don't look at me. They're the ones that didn't turn out the faith audience. We hired them.
One other thing that you pointed out in your piece was that if you go to a mega church or a lot of larger churches, it's like a rock concert. They have big video screens. They have excellent sound. They have bands putting out a really entertaining product. And they found a use for clips. And they said, wow, these churches are doing a lot of video. And normally it was just to show lyrics of songs. But they said, hey, if you share them a clip and they want to show it, they've got all the equipment set up. You go to a Catholic church, there's no screen in there. So you're not going to reach the Catholics. But if you go to a mega church, they're ready for a multimedia presentation. So if you've got a great clip from Hidden Figures, it's going to work great in their show, if you want to put it that way. In the worship that they create, they like multimedia.
Yeah, well, think of it like solving a problem, right? If you are a pastor at a church with 20,000 or 25,000 congregants and a big system of screens and whatever technology, and you want something to put on it. You don't just want to list the lyrics to a hymn or something. And consultants realized that and told studios, which are filled with people who are not generally familiar with that phenomenon, hey, get your clips out to these people. It's one of the things that I was surprised at most, actually. I guess I shouldn't have been, but as I talked to studio executives, they're like, there are actually churches that have screens now. And I'm like, oh my God, get with it, you guys.
they think John 3:16 is a quote. No, it's a Bible verse.
Well, now, speaking of studio executives, it seems like most of the studio executives that you talked to, they kind of refused to comment on the story, and they all said, well, we don't comment on marketing, but they tend to do it when they are talking about their tie-ins with McDonald's or Burger King.
That's right. That's a very, I should use that comeback the next time they tell me that. They are super sensitive about this. They say that the minute that a movie gets branded or there's a whiff around it of religion, that the worry is that mainstream, quote, in quotes, moviegoers will avoid it, will decide it's not for them. I tried pushing them to say, okay, but where's the proof of that? There doesn't seem to be a lot of proof. It seems to be one of those fears that gets kind of locked in the studio DNA. In general, did not want to talk about this. Some of them insisted that no, we weren't doing anything, and then as I reported along, found out no, actually there's a huge faith effort. I compared it to Black Ops, which is probably a little too dramatic, but that's what we called it.
Well, speaking of Black Ops and kind of doing things on the sly, I was watching a trailer the other day for A Dog's Purpose. This is an upcoming movie. I think it's from Amblin Entertainment or Amblin Partners or whatever they're called now. And at the bottom, it seemed overtly kind of not religious necessarily, but kind of a family film that that skewed towards faith-based audiences, and it had a kind of phone number and URL website for group ticket purchases, which seemed to kind of call out directly to church groups, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, you always want to create a link, right, between our marketing efforts and selling tickets. And if you can get a group of a youth group, a group of people of any size to buy, to turn up on opening weekend, you've got a lot of tickets sold. I think one of the Hidden Figures projects, among many, was to bring sororities, black sororities in this case, to a theater in Philadelphia, and they sold, I think, 1,000 tickets that way.
When speaking to the studio executives or the marketing people, did they admit that like TV ads just aren't having the punch anymore that they used to? Like, you can run ads on major networks, but people aren't seeing them for 2 or 3 or 5 days, and it's just not helping that opening weekend like it used to.
Yeah, they definitely admit that. Again, not speaking publicly because they don't talk about marketing.
But is that a new lie? I've never heard that claim before.
It's part of the smoke and mirrors. It's, you know, we don't want people thinking that we're manipulating them, even though we spend all of our time thinking about how to manipulate them into buying our tickets. The thing with television ads is, it's still, they say, the most effective way to reach people, even though it's less effective. And there's also this who will go first feeling among filmmakers. No one wants to be the one who is the test case. Oh, okay, we won't run ads on NBC for your movie because we don't think they're really effective anyway. They're, you know, Steven Spielberg saying, yeah, try that with someone else because, you know, you're going to buy them for me.
I would say the same thing is true of this shortened window and theatrical window and day and date releases. You know, everybody wants to try it, but not on my movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so far they've been only been doing films that are kind of ancillary or have some sort of problem with them. They haven't done it on a big, fat summer blockbuster or something that is going to sell regardless. And a lot of that just has to do with how much money is at stake in the budget and costs, and who is involved on the backside, filmmakers, producers, stars.
But now when Hollywood finds something that does work, it certainly, they kind of, everybody rushes towards it. It's not just one group that'll do it. So I would imagine at some point these church groups, and whether they're churches or pastors, they're going to be inundated by Hollywood marketers.
They already are to some degree. The, you know, a couple of the pastors that I talked to said they felt like it was kind of gridlock at their door. Like every movie is suddenly something that fits with our audience. And that's where it comes down to relationships and these specific consultancies. I mean, there are probably up to a dozen marketing companies that, you know, it could even be one person, but hangs their shingle out there specializing in this area. We focused on one in particular called WIT PR that seems to have a pretty good relationship with some pastors, some direct pipelines into people, because one of the founders is a pastor in Philadelphia.
So obviously, when you're pitching something like Hidden Figures, that's a good fit. It has a black cast, it's a positive message, it's family friendly. But when they start to pitch The Magnificent Seven and Warren Beatty's Rules Don't Apply, they're really, you know, shooting, they're going to go for overkill. And I think the other problem I see is that, you know, these people are going to get jaded. It's exciting the first time you go to a screening, but the 10th time it's more like work, and they won't be so happy just to be in the room and say, oh, I saw that movie in advance. They'll start to get a little savvier and say, well, this isn't for us, or they'll just get bored with the whole process because they've done it already.
That's right. And visiting a set is fun a few times, and then you realize it's actually kind of boring,
right?
He says,
"Yeah,"
in his privileged way. But the your point there is a very good one, because the risk is, like everything, when you pitch something that isn't very good, they remember that for next time. And so, the people at WIT, for example, say that's kind of the thing that they work on them, or that they're aware of the most. Their biggest challenge is trying to keep their word, make their word mean something, while also doing their jobs, right?
And then how did you come across this story? Was it pitched to you, or did you just kind of hear about it and say, you know what, I'm going to follow this one up?
Well, to be honest, the story was started by a former colleague, Michael Sipley, who left the paper in the late summer. And so at that point, I kind of inherited it and re-reported, additionally reported, and it kind of took a while to retrofit, if you will, and that's what came out. It wasn't pitched in any way.
Is them has have Wit PR or Grace Hill or anyone you've spoken to, have they said turned down work and said this movie is not appropriate to pitch? You're going to be wasting your time and it's not a good idea and we could take your money, but it's not going to work and we don't want to do it?
They say yes. They say that they turn down more than they accept. And a little hard time finding evidence of that. that was a little squishy, but that's what they say.
And finally, they talk about, hey, they're trying to reach these people and they're trying to reach millennials. Studios are often focused on the fact that young people, they want to make sure they keep the habit of going to the movies. And one statistic you pointed to in the piece was that 41% of millennials are active worshipers. And of course, studios are worried they're not going to movies as much. So reaching them at a megachurch can't hurt. But looking at the trends, I think it's true that millennial worship attending has gone down in the few decades, and more millennials identify as non-worshippers or people who don't affiliate with any faith. So I'm not sure if long term that's a way to reach young people. You know, that's they're still at church, but not as much as they used to be.
That's right. Stat, if I'm right, was something about that percentage prays daily, and that could be a wide variety of things, and it doesn't mean that they actually go to church. A lot of pastors now actually have developed, cultivated big social media followings, and a lot get their staying in touch that way.
So what you're saying is we're not just going to be governed by tweet, but we'll be praying by tweet.
That's right. You already are.
Exactly.
And so studios will learn their lesson. They'll burn out a little bit by trying to pitch every single movie for a while to the mega churches, and they'll realize that's not the case either. But they're going to find a happy new ground where instead of only paying attention when they've got a Bible film, they're going to do it when they have a movie that works and makes sense for that audience.
Right. I mean, look at their movies that have clearly not worked because they just haven't been very good. Ben-Hur is a good example. You know, the consultants, a lot of consultants were hired on that. I think that the faith community, the pastors, can now are savvy enough to this marketing practice to be able to read the body language when something just isn't that great. And they can also judge for themselves, right? And so... There's an example of just, you know, something not working. But on the other hand, some of these movies that you wouldn't suspect would be fits are pretty interesting. The way that they, you know, when I talk to the congregants and pastors, some say, well, our tendency, our you know, the knee-jerk setting is to ignore Hollywood movies. They're filled with sex and violence. We don't want them. And then when these marketers kind of go in very specifically and say, okay, but think about it like this, or there's a different set of images and trailers that are even created for this group, they say, oh, wait, okay, maybe I'll, you know, at least give it a chance. And that's what they're getting at. That's the hope.
Well, certainly it's a fascinating piece, and we will... place links to it in our show notes, and we really appreciate you taking the time to kind of go over it with us, and not only the story itself, but how you kind of came up with it and pursued it.
I appreciate your reading it. Listen, it came out over Christmas, so happy to have the attention on it.
Now let us pray.
Okay, I'll leave that to you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and good luck with what I know is about to be a very busy season for you.
It is the height of, you know, the awards frivolousness, and hopefully people won't be as outraged, or there won't be a reason for outrage like there was last year. We'll see.
Well, if last night is any indication at the Golden Globes, there might not be.
the whole new reason for outrage.
Exactly. Good point. Good point. Different reason, but yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. That was Brooks Barnes of the New York Times joining us to talk about his piece. It was titled Secular Hollywood Quietly Courts the Faithful.
I'm still most shocked that they refused to comment on it. The idea that they don't ever want to mention that they market anything ever, that's weird to me. I've never heard that idea before.
Yeah, you know, a couple of years ago, the Motion Picture Association of America in their annual kind of like, here's how much a movie costs and here's how many tickets we're selling and all their data, so to speak, they took out how much it costs to market a movie on average. And it was very noticeable at the time and they never put it back in.
Well, and it was nice of Brooks Barnes to come by for a godless journalist. He was very friendly.
Well, how do you know he's godless?
I'm just assuming all journalists are.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, the views of Michael Giltz may not be the views of...
All right, let's wind it up.
All right, well, I guess I'm not going to touch that one. Instead, I will tell you that, you know, like most churches and most religious ceremonies or practices... It's weekly, right? You know, the Sabbath is every week. Kind of like our show. In fact, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show, and we do appreciate it when you subscribe to the show and you rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. And in fact, if you can't find our show, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T. @showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I realized as I was saying that I'm talking to people who didn't find the show, so how would they know to call us or write to us? But still, you can write to us and call us and leave us comments about each show or past shows or future shows, and we do appreciate it when you do that.
We had a little Philip in a show posted recently that one of our listeners pointed out to us that there was a dropout in audio. So, you know, please, anything you think we know about it, we don't. Let us know and we'll check it out and fix it.
And we did check it out and fix that. So thank you very much. Now, that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle, and we promise not to pray on Twitter. I don't know where I was headed with that statement. Also, we're on Facebook. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and up our page should come. Again, all of that information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the end and beginning of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's only a heathen would think you only worship once a week.com.
Oh, wow. That was like a callback from like, you know, 10
Two
seconds
minutes
ago. Exactly.
Not much of a callback. Just yeah. Pointing it out.
Oh, well, okay. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, because it's such a long URL, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, or the Huffington Post, where some of his coverage can be found. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.